she was gonna keep. Oh yeah, alright, take it easy baby, make it last all night. She was an American girl.
This is Deborah Craddock, a podcast where we sit down with everyday Americans and hear their extraordinary stories. I'm your host, Deborah Drucker. Come along with me as we discuss those things that we were always told not to talk about: politics, religion, and more. I promise you'll be inspired and have your mind opened by the end of this episode.
Well, it was kind of cold that night. She stood alone on the balcony. Yeah, she could hear the cars roll by out on 441, like waves crashing on the beach.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Deborah Craddock. Today on Deborah Craddock, we will be getting to know Kara Ruta. Kara is an author, best-selling author, I should say, community activist, entrepreneur, wife, mother, and born and bred American gal. So, Kara, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me, Debbie.
I know that you live in Laguna Beach now. Where are you from originally?
Yeah, that sounds like it shouldn't be a trick question, but it really is. I was born in Evanston, Illinois, but by the time I was going to high school, I'd lived in, I think, six states. My dad's a professor, and so we moved from, I was born at Northwestern, my sister was born at USC, my brother's born at, not literally, you know what I mean, but my dad was teaching at UT Austin when my brother was born, and then we got our first pet at Harvard, and then we moved to Ohio State, so that's where I ended up in high school.
Okay, and I just heard that you have a sister and a brother, so We know you grew up with them. Did you grow up with your mom and your dad?
I did. Until 16, then they got a divorce.
How did that go as a professor's child?
Yeah, like almost like being in the military, because you move around a lot until you get tenure. And he was around, though, because, I mean, he'd have summers off. We'd have great summer trips. But he was always working pretty hard. He also had a side hustle kind of in management consulting, which he ended up doing full-time after a while. And so, yeah, but he was around.
So was that a happy upbringing?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, really happy.
A lot of fun.
Yeah. I mean, one of my favorite memories is these hula hoop contests he would organize when we lived in Texas, which is really fun. And I don't know why that popped into my head, but yeah, just a really fun, like, kind of all-American upbringing, no matter what part of the country. And I do think it's really nice to have experienced all these different regions of the country growing up. The only one I didn't live in growing up was the Southeast, and that's where I ended up going to college. So I feel like I've had a chance to live in lots of parts of the country.
So you've really seen America.
Yeah.
Was there politics discussed, or did politics play a role in your home?
Yeah, I mean, I would say my dad was pretty vocal Democrat growing up and very liberal. He, one of his first books was The Corporate Social Challenge, and it talked a lot about how corporations should feel an obligation to the communities that they, you know, that they are established in, that they, you know, kind of pay back. And I think I got a lot of that just empirically growing up. My mom would be like, if you ask her that question, she would never answer you. I still don't know really what she is, but I always kind of identified myself as a Democrat and have to this day. And I remember my first campaign was one of my teachers in high school decided to run for city council. And so I went door to door for him. So, you know, I've always been pretty active.
Did you always have the big imagination?
Yeah, I mean, I knew from third grade on that I wanted to be an author or a writer. And so, I mean, that's kind of part of the whole story of writing is you've got to harness your imagination and kind of fine tune it and create a story from it. So my teacher, I was living in Massachusetts at the time, and my third grade teacher said, write to a person you want to be when you grow up. And so little Kara wrote to Robert McCloskey, who is the author of Make Way for Ducklings and Blueberries for Sal, all my favorite books at the time, very New Englander too. And he wrote back, dear Kara, you should do your research better. I'm an illustrator, not an author. And, you know, when I'm talking to people in the writing world, I say that's kind of the that's kind of one of the really realities of the publishing industry. There's never like an easy path. It's like, I found a person to look up to. Oops, picked the wrong person. You know, that kind of thing. But anyway, at least he wrote me back. So that was fun.
So as a child with this big imagination, what do you think the weirdest thing you ever did as a kid was?
I don't know. I'm pretty shy too. So I don't know that I would have stood out at all. Like I liked building forts and writing stories. I mean, I was always writing poetry, always reading. I mean, I kind of sound nerdy, right? We were like a pretty cerebral family. It's not like we weren't like a sports family. We were just, we would be reading a lot. We always had libraries in every house. And I don't know anything.
So did you start writing stories as a little kid? And what inspired those stories?
Yeah, my first published book was called Skipper and Scooter. And it was in fifth grade. And my librarian, Mrs. Gardier, laminated it. And, you know, I illustrated it as well. It was about twin boys that got into trouble. And so Mrs. Gardier put it, laminated it, and put it on the shelf at the library so people could check it out. I was so excited. It like, day made.
I know that you just said that your family leaned Democratic. You're not certain what your mom was. Mm-hmm. Did you have any religion in the home?
We did. When we were younger, I remember maybe even up to Texas. I kind of do it by places. But my dad was raised in the Church of Christ, which is a pretty fundamentalist Christian church. And his parents, my grandparents, still attended when they were alive. And then my mom was, her family's Episcopal, but not really practicing. So I know my dad was like a Sunday school teacher at some point when I was little in the Church of Christ. But then by the time we had moved to Massachusetts, we didn't go to church anymore.
So how did you arrive at your personal political perspective? Has it changed over the years?
Yeah, my politics are pretty much the same as they have been.
Did religion inform any of that?
No, I feel like, I really do feel like religion and politics are separate in my mind, or they should be, at least. I think religion can give you a foundation as a principled person and should, no matter what your religion is. And it should help inform your views of the world and how you want to help and give back and that kind of thing. And politics is a means to that end.
So how do you feel about the state of this hardcore right-wing Christian contingent putting their religious beliefs so heavily into politics?
Right. I feel the same as the hardcore left trying to put whatever they're putting into it. It's just, it should be separate. I just, I think everyone's lost, like on the edges, everybody's lost sight of what's central and foundational to just people and being nice and kind to each other. And that's the foundation of religion, right? Do unto others and all that.
Do you bring religion into your home now, or did you impart that religion to your kids?
You know, it's funny. And then when we moved to Ohio, we hadn't gone to church in Massachusetts that I remember. And my first best friend in Columbus asked me if I wanted to go to church with them. And turns out it's Church of Christ, like following me around again. So I went with her. And I will say that, and then I, you know, like joined that church and I went probably all the way through after middle school, just by myself, not with my family, but with her family. And I really found it to be really grounding. And I, you know, it's a place where Church of Christ, you go Sunday morning, Sunday evening, and Wednesdays, and you read the Bible from front to back. So it was really a great education, and Susan's family was amazing. So that being said, when we had kids, we ended up getting married at kind of a non-denominational Christian church with Pastor Bomber was an amazing pastor. He baptized all four kids, and we ended up sending them to a Christian preschool, but more like in the Methodist kind of, you know, not too heavy Christian way. But I really like, I like that foundation. I just do. And the kids didn't really even know that they were going to.
So until this day, does that somewhat bring you a source of solace in times of trouble, or does it prop
Absolutely.
You up when you need some support?
Yeah. And I think my kids would say, you know, that they, Mom, you should be spiritual, not religious. And I do, they've taught me that you can be that as well, like maybe broader just in your own practice and through meditation and personal evolution, but I love having the grounding that I did.
So you have the foundation, yeah. And that helps you.
It does.
Where did you actually grow up into the person sitting before me?
Well, I think all of those places, but to feel comfortable, like speaking to you in a podcast and having a byline that's visible, and that's just such an evolution. The funny thing that happened to me was I'd always wanted to write, and I kept getting stuck in marketing, which is how I could make money. But while I was doing the marketing stuff, the American Marketing Association asked me to write a manual. I put together this proposal. Then I realized, like, if they're interested, maybe I could sell this book. So I sent the proposal on the same day, which you're not supposed to do, to an editor in New York, to an agent. Both of them called the next day and wanted the book. So suddenly I find myself writing a business book like my dad had about marketing, which I never wanted to do, never imagined. And then segue after the book publishes, you have to go out and speak when you write a business book. Like, you have to build your platform. So Real You Incorporated, 8 Essentials for Women Entrepreneurs comes out, and the publisher books a speaking engagement. So I'm supposed to be going to these huge conventions, like women's conventions all over the country. And I'm freaked out. I don't know how to do this. I'm shy.
Tell us about Real You Incorporated.
It's an 8-step process I kind of came up with to help articulate how you put your personal brand into your business brand and make it unique. And I loved working with women in real estate. I love the fact that residential real estate was one of the first careers women could make as much as or more than men. There was no glass ceiling. And so it's really an empowering field when you think about it. So
what my mom did to support us when she was a single mom.
Exactly. And I mean, this was a career that was open to women like that. And there was no glass ceiling. It was awesome. So I got to work with a lot of women across the country, helping rebrand them and build their brands within a real estate brand. So our Real Living was the umbrella brand, and then they would have their own business underneath it. And so the book was about that, not just for residential real estate agents, but for any woman that's an entrepreneur starting her own business.
This was your first commercial book.
Yes. Yes. Okay. And then, so then I hired Arthur, the speech coach, and he helped me figure out how my hair was supposed to look and how I'm supposed to speak and to take calm, loving breaths, which I still forget to do sometimes. But anyway, it enabled me to go start speaking around the country. So when we ended up selling the Real Living real estate brand that I created. See, I love creating brands. So I created the first woman-focused residential real estate brand in the country. When we came to market in the early 2000s, all of the advertising and all of real estate was two men shaking hands, white men shaking hands in front of a real estate yard sign. And that would be like what real estate was supposed to be. It was all marketed to men, and women make or control 91, probably higher percentage of all home purchases. And and they were totally being not marketed to. So I kind of changed the paradigm and we started marketing to women. I remember when we first like did this roll up of companies, and I came up with a brand, and we, kind of overlaid it all these companies. And I'm like, and when you talk to her, and I would use the feminine pronoun for your customer, and all these guys, old real estate guys, would be like, who's her? What's she? What are you doing? Because they just hadn't thought that way. When Harley and I bought our first house, our real estate agent gave us a tie as our closing gifts. So, there was a lot of work to be done in that industry, and it was fun to do it. But after we sold the Real Living residential real estate brand to Warren Buffett, I like to say that. I mean, it wasn't him personally, but, his company. All of a sudden, I don't have a job anymore, and it was the first time I hadn't had a job in a long time. And we were able to move to Malibu because we were in Ohio still. And I'm like, oh, and Harley was running the company. And I'm like, you can do that from anywhere. So my son had picked Chapman to go to college because I might have only showed him California colleges. And so I didn't want to land right on top of him. So I flew into LAX and I met with a real estate agent, and she's like, okay. And she's showing me Brentwood and like Pacific Palisade, normal places, like suburban places like we'd always lived. I'm like, oh, no, I need the ocean. I need something different. I've been in the suburbs for so long. And she's like, the only place I can think of is Malibu. Sure enough, out we go to Malibu. And the only thing I could afford to rent, because Harley had given me a really low budget because he was thinking I was having a midlife crisis. Maybe I was, but it all worked out. And so I rented this round house, like 4 houses from the beach. It was so fabulous. And all of my kids had pizza-shaped rooms.
So this was just to test the water, see if you really liked Malibu.
And I knew we would. But so then I got the kids settled in Malibu High and Trace and Chapman. And I'm sitting there in my roundhouse by the beach. And I'm thinking, you know, you've been going around the country telling women to live the life of their dreams. It's never too late to put your passion into action. And I remember I was speaking at this Dallas Women's Expo, and I was giving my speech, and this woman in the front row raises her hand. She's like, "What dream haven't you done?" And I'm like, "Oh, writing a novel. That's been my dream since third grade." So that's when I sat down and started writing the novel.
And what was that first novel?
It was called Here, Home, Hope. And it's, it was a happy story of, and it published in 2011, which is great.
That was the catalyst to continue.
Yeah.
And is there suspense in that as well?
No, that was pure women's fiction. They wanted me to stick to that. And then from there, I wrote about, it's called In the Mirror, and it's a book about a young mom with a breast cancer diagnosis. And that was a friend of mine, a story close to my heart.
When you meet your husband, Harley, you're living in Ohio. When did it come to be that you felt passionate about being a community activist? I see you created the first walk-in emergency shelter. It's called Make Room Columbus.
Make Room Columbus, yeah. We had just started dating, and I read an article in the New Yorker magazine about homeless families by Jonathan Franz, and it was based on a book, Rachel and Her Children. And I read about this, and it never occurred to me that there were families that were homeless. And then, so I went and met with the shelter director for the men's shelter in Columbus. His name is Kent Beidle. I'll never forget this because I went on my lunch break. I was working in an ad agency at the time. And, you know, he's like carrying a gun and a knife. And, you know, it was pretty gnarly. And he sits down and I said, okay, what happens to the families? Like, what about a dad and a mom and their kids? That's all they have left. And he's like, oh no, we split them up. There's no family shelter. So the men and any boy over 16 comes to me, and the women and the younger children go to a women's shelter. I'm like, oh my God, that's terrible.
Tragic.
It still gives me
because
it's the last thing they have. Right. And then you're going to split them up. So I'm like, well, that's just ridiculous. We've got to do something about it. So that's literally how it started. And then I ended up with my friends and kind of rallying the community. I got a couple of banks to get involved. And we ended up at one point about 200 volunteers. You know, we had a newsletter and monthly meetings. And and so we built the first walk-in emergency shelter for homeless.
And does it still exist?
Yeah, it merged with the Faith Mission. And I know the playground still exists. And I think they have Make Room Columbus on one wing of it. But yeah.
What did you learn from those homeless people? What do you think primarily causes homelessness?
You know, there's so many different reasons. For the families that I worked with, it's bad luck. I mean, there's any number of things that can happen. You can have a medical crisis. You can lose your job. You can anything like that. Nowadays, the rent's skyrocketing. There's any number of things that can push a family that's living paycheck to paycheck just over the edge.
So how do you feel about an increase in the minimum wage? Do you think that would help some of these homeless people? Or do you think it's more job training or just lack of opportunity?
Well,
mental illness?
Yeah, there's so much. It's just, we need affordable housing. We need mental health. We don't have any mental health safety nets. There's a lot of really good locally based programs. I love food banks as well. I found them so supportive and important in the homeless families that I was serving. Anyway, there's systems in place, but there's no national focus that we need. And we need a statewide focus, and then you need national, and you need somebody paying attention to it at all times, because money will be allocated and then it just evaporates. We need to come together and fix this.
So at which juncture did you meet your husband?
It was funny. My husband is an attorney. And when I found out during this, starting this charity, that I needed articles of incorporation, becoming a 501c3. I'm like, well, I met this cute guy who's an attorney. So how would you like to help me with my charity? And he did. And I do really think that we grew close because we had this shared, passion about creating the shelter, and we got to spend a lot of time together. Anyway, but when the shelter opened, we had married, and our first little guy had arrived. And so it was kind of fun to see him on the playground with the kids, it came kind of full circle.
You're involved in some really amazing organizations. Human Rights Watch SoCal Board. Mm-hmm. You work with Tahrir Justice Center.
Yep. And I haven't been active with them lately, but they help women fleeing violence from all over the world trying to get to into the country. And they will supply, the out of all of the many requests for help, they will put together pro bono attorneys with these women seeking asylum. And without an attorney, your case is almost always thrown out. And with an attorney, they have a great success rate.
So are they here? Have they achieved refugee status? Is that how it happens?
Like, yeah, asylum. Yeah, they're seeking asylum. And they have to, you know, go through a really lengthy process. And without an attorney, you just can't make it happen.
It's like an amazing organization. What is the latest commissioner position?
Commissioner Kara. Okay, so I didn't know about
should
this.
Should I salute you?
I think you should do something. I'm not sure because I've never been a commissioner before. But the governor appointed me to the California Volunteers Commission. And our entire job is to help make sure every Californian volunteers at least an hour a week in their community. That's a basic ask. So, but it does much more than that. So I'm just learning because I was appointed during the pandemic. So I've been on Zoom calls and everything, but I haven't been able to be a full
the
commissioner.
The governor being
Newsom.
Gavin Newsom.
Yeah. So I had to go through this interview process to be a commissioner.
Did you apply?
Well, yeah. So my husband's campaign team, when he was running for Congress, they're like, I said, I feel like I should be doing more like in the state. Like, I just feel like I should be helping here. And his campaign director, Alyssa, she's like, well, we think you'd be great on the California Women's Commission, which, you know, was advocate for women and girls and all this stuff. Well, I didn't make the cut on that one. So, but the people that were interviewing me recommended me for this California Volunteers Commission. So then I was happy again. And then I went through the interview process again, and now I'm a commissioner.
I don't want to go too much into your husband's political career, but I do want to ask you, what was your role as the wife of a congressman for those 2 years?
Yeah, I think the spouse role starts as soon as your person decides to run. So it's from the campaign all the way through winning, all the way through losing, all the way through another campaign. So you're never really finished. And I think what I learned is the spouse's role can be as much, you know, you can't do nothing because you just can't do nothing, but you can be as little. Some women and men who are spouses choose to be less involved. Some choose to be all the way involved. I decided, since I pretty much talked him into it, that I should be really involved. So I was really involved. And, you know, I tried to spend about 10 days a month in D.C. when he was there. So we'd have a weekend together so he didn't have to fly back and forth the whole time. And we really embraced it. I mean, he got more done legislatively than any other freshman congressman. And I, you know, got to know spouses and volunteered for the First Ladies Luncheon and got involved. You know, I feel like if you're going to do something, jump all the way in.
Let me ask you something about your career as a writer. Mm-hmm. How does someone so hopeful in such a lovely life write such dark, suspenseful novels? Where does that come from?
I think it's, I started writing with kind of this empowerment message in the women's fiction world, and then I just started getting darker and darker and darker and darker. And I don't really know, I can't really explain it, but by the time Paul and Best Day Ever popped into my head, it was definitely going dark. And The Favorite Daughter then was pretty dark, and Somebody's Home's kind of scary. And yeah, my next one, The Widow, is also kind of scary as well. Set in D.C. So, yeah, I don't know exactly, but I think it's just things aren't what they seem, are they?
Maybe your life, I'm just guessing, is beautiful, and you also are aware of the darkness around, and that darkness comes
seeped
out.
In. Yeah, it's, you know,
it's
and
an
I
outlet.
Did, it is kind of an outlet because it's a way to process. The Somebody's Home is a book which has a lot of the things that were happening in Orange County with the teenagers playing beer pong with the swastika. It has, you know, a lot of, it's got a young man who gets caught up in the kind of militia type world. And I went to some hearings there about domestic terrorists in DC and just listened to all the experts. And so that kind of seeped in. And so I guess, yeah, you're probably right. I'm kind of processing through fiction and trying to make sense of the world in a way.
Why don't you tell us what your book, your latest book is called, and where we can find it, and what's a little bit about?
Sure. Yeah, my latest is called The Widow. It was called The Widow's Mandate, but it was getting the name during the pandemic, so people were over mandates. So, but The Widow's Mandate is a tradition in D.C. when if a sitting congressperson dies in office, then their spouse can run in the House. The spouse can run in a special election to fulfill the term if she wins or he wins. And then in the Senate, the governor appoints typically the spouse to fulfill the seat of the term. So I just found that to be an interesting tradition and started kind of digging into that. The way of the first woman who served in the House was a widow's mandate.
Is that similar to what happened with Sonny Bono?
Yes, yeah. But back in the day, it was when women weren't, allowed to run. And so this was the way that they were able to run for or get a seat in Congress. So anyway, so I thought that was kind of a fun tradition. And so the story is about when a cheating congressman meets an untimely demise, his wife invokes the widow's mandate to get her revenge. So this one's Ohio and D.C., based on my 2 years spent there and really getting to know it. I loved the Library of Congress. I was training to be a docent there and, all the, cause there's so much glittery, so much history, so much power, so much backstabbing. There was just so much to write about. I had to set a book there.
Well, I can't wait to read it. And do you have a website or?
Oh yeah. Yeah. So you can find my books anywhere books are sold, but you can find me at kararuda.com. It's very hard. KairaRouda.com. I'm also on all social media platforms as that name as well. And any bookstore or online, you can get my books.
It's been an honor to hear about Kara Ruda. And I know I love you because you are one of my good friends, and I'm so fortunate to have you in my life.
Aww.
So thank you. You are a kick-ass American, and you do just what everybody needs to be doing out there. So thank you so much.
Aw, thanks for having me.
This episode of Deborah Craddock was hosted by me, Deborah Drucker. It was edited by Juan Sanson and produced by Lee Rocker and Chloe Casson.
Well, she was
our amazing music
girl.
Was performed by Amy Nelson and Kathy Guthrie of Folk Uke. Be sure to rate and review this episode wherever you listen to podcasts. For more Deborah Craddock, check out DeborahCraddock.com and our Instagram at Deborah Craddock. That's D-E-B-O-R-A-H Craddock, like Democratic. Until next time.
Political is personal, so let's talk about it. We've been there, we've had it, it's all.